Log Talk Radio.
Day, the 85th day of the year right now. It only leaves us with 280. It's interesting. We only have 86 days left until summer, in case you were wondering. It's exceptional. We have some interesting talking points today. And I think a contemporary, a commentary that is deserving of our attention. This one has to do with the stewards of extinction. We have. I'm going to be in the upcoming weeks. We're going to be talking about the canary in the Masonic coal mine, the myths and the misguided thinking behind that. And coming into a perhaps tedious re-mention of the nature of masonry, this is, after all, gentlemen, a celebration. It's not widely understood, nor does it necessarily have to be. We're not a group that is going to march around the world expecting people to join us. It is what it is. It's for the outreach that I think that is most predominant is how we define ourselves intellectually. And I think that's thoughtfully. If we present ourselves as an organization of thoughtful men, then we will tend to appeal to thoughtful men. And I think over the years, we've appealed to different groups of people for different reasons. All of them legitimate in and of their day. We have to give them their due, give the time frame that has passed its due course. The ideas don't necessarily pass, as you and I know. History passes and carries on ideas. We would tend to, if we had control over this, to feel that we would filter out only the very best ideas, and the ones that lead to the most positive outcomes. Only hindsight allows us to do that. Philosophical reasoning continues to evolve, and be passed on, because the ideas are accessible and have some validation in natural law. If it doesn't meet that test, then it seems almost an artificial fit. Today we are grateful. We're grateful for what we have, but the greater need around us is talking very loudly. Not so long after the last great wars, there was a sense of commitment to do anything that would reduce the potential for that type of conflict, that type of a global psychosis to ever happen again. And what we saw, what history teaches us, is that there's always efforts to consolidate, to set aside our national boundaries for the sake of the greater good. After the wars, the greater good is defined as not only me and you, but everybody around us. that tends to happen when war zones extend across whole nations and across whole continents, and in fact around the world. Understandably, just like everything else, those lessons have been, they become time-worn and become more opaque as the days go by. And we find ourselves faced with that today. There is a growing populist sense of nationalism, where there is the thought, it's not the deed, but the thought that we would be safer and better if we pull back into our separate cultures and countries, defined our boundaries, and did the and pushed back anybody. So we're dividing people along political and ethnic lines. And once again, now, repeatedly, history has told us that we know that this, and we know where this ends up every single time, but we seem to be tolerant of the price that some zealots are willing to pay. This, I think it's important. The free thinkers out there, the free men amongst us, will realize the folly. You've heard the stories. I remember the stories of, and I believe them. You tell me if I'm naive here, brethren. The stories of the soldiers weary of shooting at each other, weary of killing an anonymous person for the sake of what? Now, the armchair philosophers and politicians and soldiers allows us to sit back and conjure up the noble deed. But the stories that I've heard from the front is quite a bit different. It's the practical sense that people are dying and people are killing. And at the end of the day, for what? Why do you impose that type of scar? It sounds from the reports of these men and women that the politics seems to take a very secondary. The nationalism doesn't become as important as that sense of protecting your mates, and the other soldier's sense of protecting your mates. We've heard this story, and I like this story about the Christmas Eve, where soldiers on both sides, led by Masonic influences on both sides, laid down their weapons. And in fact, a football match broke out, a soccer match broke out. And for a night, the brethren were just that. I tend to believe that story. I don't think it's propaganda. I tend to believe that it's true. And when I've listened to the men and women who have nightmares about the battles, I can see why there's a balance point. There is something noble about the battlefront, and we need that to be able to handle the carnage that we see, the strangeness, the exceptional, deliberate danger that we impose. What's harder is to set that aside when we step away from the battlefield, because those boundaries aren't clear. There are boundaries in our minds, and then any intelligent person realizes that type of chaos can break out around us. We can sometimes forget that the reason that it doesn't is because there are more people that like the predictable nature existence. And to be living in a predictable existence means that there is some safety. And so, if we are subscribed to the idea that being predictable and living safe is worth certain sacrifices, then we sacrifice ourselves to the need to be policed. Not to be bullied, not to have some of the nonsense that's been going on in the last 20 years happen. We don't sanction that. The illegal beatings by our people in uniform, all of that stuff, in our minds, we divorce. We divorce from the honorable and true and essential democratic purpose. It's necessary to have our protectors well-trained and well-equipped, but they have to be also people that can think for themselves. And too often, they're not. They're thinking emotionally. They're thinking about the power in their hands. And not all people that are trained in that way are safe. And of course, what a person was like in their early stages doesn't necessarily mean it's going to continue over the course of a lifetime. People do change. And living a life where you're seeing the underside of a culture has to change a person. What do you need to maintain some careful balance? Well, we see a lot of people in uniform coming to Freemasonry because it is a balance point. It is a sense. It's not a paramilitary organization, although a lot of those people feel safe when they have that kind of predictableness. They're people that can, for their own reasons, surrender to autocracy. In the outside world, we find that intolerable. Culturally and morally intolerable. So we have approximations, and compared to an autocratic state or a police state where orders are given and people are in line, it's much the same as what we think is going on in Northern Korea. We find that intolerable. The ultimate, if we follow the logic that putting us in uniforms and living efficiently is the best way to live, then the best way to live is to start killing everybody off, because then we reduce our expectations. We remove suffering completely. Not exactly feasible, is it? We've got a dilly of a commentary today. I think you're really going to like it. And we're going to talk a bit, and we're going to hint a little bit about what's coming up in one of the shows. We've got some really, I think, I've been listening to you guys again, and you're a scary bunch. There's no question about that. But you're coming up with some very remarkably clever ideas. Things are changing around us. Will that, how do we maintain our link with ideas that go back into the Middle Ages and medieval times, philosophies and operations? How do we do that and have that that conversation with ourselves about the dealing with the change that's happening, the situation that's happening around us that's dominating the cultural conversations? We'll get into that as soon as we get back here. I think you're going to like this. This is from a Canadian jazz singer, Emily Claire Barlow. And this is a tune called Gentle Rain. Yeah, it's raining around here right now. Here, enjoy. Thank you. Sometimes you just want songs that quit, don't you? You just want it over with. And then sometimes there's arrangements and musicianship like that that's just inspired. That sax player, I think it's Phil Dwyer, Canadian guy, and one critic refer to it like this. It sounds like he took a challenging key signature suited for a guitarist and turned it into pure gold. I mean, anyway, I think that's the kind of music that you deserve. That's the kind that, you know, you sit back, fill up your mug with your favorite comfort or libation, and sit back and join us for the next little while. And we're going to talk about things that have relevance and bearing on our vast and amazing Masonic order. But before we go on, let's talk more about our commentary for today. Fantastic. Gets us all in a good frame of mind. And thanks for a little piece of music from the heart of the world, huh? I was in a reflective mood when I wrote this, sort of noticing things. I tend, like a lot of you, to be buoyant, to be optimistic. And unlike a lot of people, I find myself at times shamefully naive, trusting, You have a need for the world to be a trusting place and to see around me the good. And I don't just say that because it's popular to say. I've had some time, some serious things going on in my life. And this happens in everybody's life, if you get to be this age, where you reflect on things, begin to notice things, and sort out and resort priorities. And I'm not one of those people that's so bold or thoughtless that I would say that I have no regrets. I do. And I'm not one to say I never wasted a moment. I was not inside my head with the chatter of being driven by some ideology. You know, spend every second to make every penny. No, I don't worship at the same altar as those folks do. And I think that from education gives everybody, whether it's by experience or in the study hall, or if you're fortunate with good mentors or professors, it enriches the world. So the so-called idle moments are moments that are treasured. Now, any of you who are out there listening who may not be able, not have a group of people around to have these kind of conversations or talk about thoughtful issues without feeling self-conscious, that's perfectly understandable. That's one of the purposes of Masonic effects, to connect. And it's an uncommon kind of a connection. So let me pull back and talk to you about hopefully, if I was at all effective, you'll see what was going on through my mind's eye when I wrote this, and then you can give me some advice. And this is really talking about awakening something in you. See if you can, if I made my point. The planets have moved around us, and we have moved within them. Plying the trade for men's souls has become decentralized, either left to zealots on a battlefield or those who's with history responsibly that enslaves change, with historic responsibility that enslaves change. What was I thinking about when I wrote that? Those people, those despots, the autocrats. Change becomes a component of a different ideology. It serves either a military purpose or it has no value, or a capitalist purpose or it has no value. Isn't that interesting that I not thought of that? Wonder which one of you pointed that out to me. We are at a point in human history in which the shortcomings of our fathers have been visited on us. I mean that figuratively. Look around, nationalism is on the rise. And the populist movement has everybody's eyes just pleasantly glazed over. Now, if you think about it, gentlemen, we've been here before. We, men, thoughtful men, we've visited this before. What have we done is one legitimate question. What have we been able to do? If we can't arrest this kind of a movement, perhaps we can shorten its glory days, and perhaps we can be there to assist with the recovery and make the recovery acute, make it as sharp a recovery as possible. And then what can we do? We can remember, as many of you do, wonderful, beautiful historians that tell the stories, not as the idle chatter of somebody that has lost perspective, that every single battle that they've ever researched is important to a listener. Often it's the histories, when they're offered without any context, are really meaningless. It's like giving somebody a list of random numbers. But if you give them context for it, it all fits together, and the richness of what's being communicated comes to the forefront. So we are at a point in which our fathers, the shortcomings of our fathers, and perhaps we share the same shortcomings, and perhaps it's a shortcoming that has more to do with the human nature. But in the background, keep natural law in mind as we go forward. some misguided sense of loyalty has left us wanting each and every time we try to justify or align to their myopia. How do we justify what they did or didn't do? Well, we have to defend what they did to the death, don't we? This is the marching season, so we have to carry on the what? The sadness of the battle? Why do we need to have that annualized? I think that trivializes it myself. Redistribution began but stopped when those who experienced for the first time advantage formerly given as a birthright became addicted to it. I wasn't one of them. Me and my clan, we were displaced by the clan chiefs, like a lot of Scottish clans, a lot of people around the world. It wasn't necessarily an external power. But he was swept away with that opportunity for greed. And me and my kind were not going to stand in the way. So we were displaced, thrown off the land. And do we have the same kind of loyalty to the clan chiefs anymore? Only a fool would be able to answer that one. But when the gentry, with the democratization, certain people were able to have access to great amounts of wealth and power. And they too became addicted to it. Not to the costs, not to the penury or the suffering or the poverty that was necessary to support those huge amounts of wealth, not the degradation. The focus was on their success and that addiction to power, so-called power. The wreckage of European colonialism smolders on each continent. Yeah. Here we tried to be good little colonialists. Little, I say. We did not necessarily overcome the social limitations of our European and British roots, as much as we may want to claim that. There were many people who wanted to align. We still have people around the countryside, very, very demonstrative of their link with the loyalists, that interesting sense of monarchy. Hard-fought rights are trivialized by a parade of disaffected generations. A lot of people sacrifice their lives for the kind of freedoms that you and I can today take for granted if we want. Education. Healthcare. Don't ever lay claim to a person like me that opportunity is equal. Don't do that, please. That's misguidance. Some of us are more equal than others. I think back through history, even recent history here in Canada, where the sound of certain accents would limit a person's chance at getting certain jobs in this country. And if you haven't been one of those families, you haven't had one of those accents, you will. It's not only happening because of an accent now, it's happening because of skin color and it's happening because of gender. Nothing exactly to be proud about. Or do we have a place that's safe? Relatively. But all that we have will fall apart unless we hold ourselves accountable for this. disaffected generations. They are right to laugh at reminders. It could happen again. Right, because when we are visited again, it will be so much worse than it was before. We are ill-prepared to exist outside our systems. Status quo. Kings and caliphs are souvenirs. Paranoia plays on weak minds. All occurs with one exception. Ha! That galvanizing sense of commonality we struggle to suppress. The Babylon, where too much outward happiness was sinful enough to warrant punishing divisions into language tribes. All the failings combined are dwarfed by what is coming. All those feelings. The things required to sustain life itself have become polluted by our failing to understand cumulative effect. If we wrote ritual today, what metaphor would we play on? Dead trees, dead forests, dead oceans? Neglect killed the last unicorn. Nowhere to run. Tainted air. Fouled water. Protective layers weakened, causing ecological change. Does the calculus of masonry include these calculations? Our contemporary masons, students of science and the arts, become stewards of extinction. It's naive of me, I know. But can we, have we awakened the alchemists? Does it matter to masonry? Well, the common good matters to true masons. Always has, always will. How we do that? That's choices. Whether we're playing games with ourselves to convince ourselves we do not have to commit to the common good, that's something that doesn't need to be mentioned a second time. If you are, you wrestle with that yourself. But the common good, the protection of nature. So I ask you, are we part of that? What is the role? What is the purpose of, what is the function of masonry in this incredible failure that's on us? Throw our hands in the air, maybe. Throw our hands in the air. This is a little John Coltrane. Take you away to these thoughts when you're approaching the commentary today. There's no pressure. There's no weapons pointed to our head. This is the air that our children's children's children will breathe, and the water that they will sip from. Hopefully it won't make them sick. The next, what we face coming ahead of us will be the battles over water. Does any man not have a role in that? Does... Mm-hmm. John Coltrane, in case you're wondering. Where do we go with this type of thing? Masonry has tremendous depth, enormous depth, and field of vision. It's remarkable. I like the way that poets help us access certain aspects of masonry. Here, how much merit does this have? Blessed is he who expects nothing, for he shall never be disappointed. It came from an 18th century poet, Alexander Pope, who's sort of known for a satirical verse, "The world forgetting by the world forgot." Does he have something to say? Yeah. This is he writes to us about some very interesting aspects of the human condition. Pride is still aiming at the best houses. Men would be angels, angels would be gods. Aspiring to be gods if angels fell. Aspiring to be angels, men rebel. It's hard to really ignore the guy, isn't it? He was writing in couplets, a style of poetry. And he was influential. He was influenced by some of the great writers. So we know he was well-read, but he was also influential on thought of the day. He may have come to this seriousness at an early age. When he was 12, he came down with a form of tuberculosis, and it deformed his body and stunted his growth. And he went through life with a severe hunchback. He always had high fevers and respiratory difficulties, and his eyes were always inflamed, and he was in pain. He was only 4'6", so he was a very small man. And so he was already removed from society because he was Catholic. Remember, if you were not like me or not like us, well, we would make our criticism and disfavor of you known to you. There's a song, there's a poem that he writes about the Pyrian Spring. And it's interesting. It's in a poem called An Essay on Criticism. It says, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Deep or taste not the Pyrian Spring. Drink deep or taste not the Pyrian Spring." The sacred spring was said to be in Perea, a region of ancient Macedonia. It was really close to Mount Olympus, and it was thought to be the home and the seat of the worship of Orpheus. Now, it was a metaphor. The Pyrian spring is the metaphorical source of knowledge of art and science. Surely we're all familiar with that. Of course we are. Of course we are. "'Tis hard to say if greater want of skill appear in writing or in judging ill. But of the two, less dangerous is the offense to tire our patience than mislead our sense. Some few in that, but numbers err in this. 10 censure wrong for one who writes amiss. A fool might once himself alone expose. Now one in verse makes many more in prose." So he's saying, despite the harmful effects of bad criticism, literature requires worthy criticism. Yeah. "And 10 low words oft crept in one dull line, while they ring round the same unvaried chimes, with sure returns of still expected rhymes. Where'er you find the cooling western breeze, in the next line it whispers through the trees. If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the readers threaten not in vain with sleep. So throughout the poem, he's referring to ancient writers, Virgil, Homer, Aristotle, and Horace, and Longinus. Well, don't we all? This is a testament to his belief that the imitation of the ancients is the ultimate standard of taste. I don't think that's an uncommon notion if we think about parallels with our order. The imitation of the ancients. But when we study them, we find that there were sacrifices they made. It was just not a shopping list without consequence or obligation. And we tend to think that if we adhere to those obligations and that self-discipline, then it will affect our thinking and similarly approximate the outcomes of the ancients. So you and I have a lifestyle that's not ordered on us. We're not in uniform. But by convenience, perhaps, by choice, we choose to follow that path, that rudder. Are we being generous? How are we handling our charities? So above all, you know, we can be quite happy working together to pull funding and to turn it over to worthy causes. That's essential. That's a wonderful experience. I think there is a diaspora, as you know, within Masonry. Yeah, if you're a ritualist, you need to go there. But to study it, you need to be within your own mind. Be careful that you don't begin to think about the tedium of Masonry or the self-consciousness. One of the things that lets us know when the values have been supplanted by peer pressure is when we walk into a room and it's a suffocatingly self-conscious, that it's an old world that we all can't throw our head back and laugh until we know that the person in charge is throwing their head back and laughing. We wouldn't want to do anything out of line, would we? Sycophants won't know what the hell I'm talking about. But the truth is, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Whether you're happy or ask yourself whether it strikes your sense of humor or not, does that depend on the people around you? I once had a grandmaster admonish me for laughing. I just thought, such a foolish aspect. To ever even presume to speak with me that way. But I'm sure you've had your own experiences with that. That's not how a Mason is corrected. But it's by that thoughtful criticism. We need that. Criticism in and of itself, well, you know, you suck it up. But if it's worthy. Now, I want to share with you a little pearl and want to see what you think about this. It has to do with a phenomena within the order that I've noticed, and you'll probably have too. Somebody does some work, and it's work that's substandard, or an effort that's hard to follow, a paper that's very painful to listen to because of a weak and unrehearsed delivery. And yet, what comes out at the end of it is a politeness of manner and high praise. And you've been to these sessions where the person's rank has prompted high praise, although it is completely mediocre work. So much for an order based on merit, I would say. Now, if you study this, I think this has fostered unintentionally It's fostered this sense of good enough. And when new eyes come into the Masonic order, if you remember the new eyes, mine were overwhelmed. It was very emotional, but I was also caught by this unique disappointment that work and memory work that was just horribly delivered would gain praise. And I couldn't, and I thought all we're doing is reinforcing the lowest common denominator, until I began to realize why. I could never understand this. Why would a whole order, and you see this in different lodges and different levels, oh my goodness, until you almost begin to think that it might be permeating the operation. Just a little moment of reflection, and before we talk about what that praise is trying to do. I think you'll love this. This is for all the people that are historians in the crowd. This is Bill Evans. Little homage to St. Patrick's Day that's just passed. And all the beauty that the Irish have brought to the world. And all the lessons they've taught us all. And still do. A proud and determined people. Hope your St. Patrick's Day celebration was worthy of you and the occasion. I'm sure it was, of course. Here, a little piece I want to illustrate about what I see going on about praise. Mm-hmm. Here, we live in a culture where a blue ribbon or a gold star or a trophy or a minimum, you know, a really good job has been really commonplace and even expected when people participate in an activity, regardless of their effort or outcome. And many feel these practices are important to build self-esteem and are harmless, but in fact, they are neither. Well, each of these events in and of themselves are not individually harmful and are sometimes perfectly appropriate. The practice of continually praising or overpraising can be. The problem with praise, people begin to expect constant acknowledgement and conversely are alarmed when they don't get it. They come to rely on external praise rather than develop internal motivation or confidence in their emerging abilities. They stop doing things because they should or they can, and instead do them for the recognition. People who come to rely on praise take fewer risks because they are unwilling to lose their praiseworthy status. Maintain the status quo. When people seek praise consciously or unconsciously, they tend to avoid anything that won't get right. Anything they won't get right. Which is unfortunate because mistakes, trial and error, and risk-taking are critical elements of any learning process. Is a Masonic craft an order that develops insight or not? Do we not follow the light? As an alternative, if we only define people by winning and grades or any time they receive praise, they feel less competent or worthy when these things are absent, like in the real world. But what should we do? We should offer encouragement for efforts and attitudes. Encouragement can be inspirational and motivating, a gentle, supportive nudge that helps us meet important goals instead of self-defining and limiting. It should be genuine. Praise that is specific. That was very kind of you to do that, rather than you're wonderful. And praise focused on behavior. You came up with a very creative solution rather than you're so smart, you know? People who received encouragement were more likely to believe their intelligence could change and they could do better if they tried hard. Whereas when people were praised, they felt their intelligence was fixed and were already avoiding experiences perceived to be challenging. Oh, dear me. Here's some examples. Good job. You're well organized. We're proud of you. That's generic or person-centered praise. Encouragement sounds something like this. You really stuck with that. Your hard work paid off. I can tell you're working hard because you're finishing more things. That was the first time you did that without an error. I appreciate the way you organized yourself. Becoming easier for you to find things and to do things. You were really invested in that. You really proved you could do it. Encouragement may not roll off the tongue so easily, but it is worth the effort. Encouragement recognizes and fosters continual growth and effort. Do not cause our brethren to compare their achievements or compete about who is smarter or prettier or wiser. Foster independence so the person gains a sense of their own abilities. That's what mentors do. Mentors don't come in and pat somebody on the head when they don't, they haven't done the work or they don't have it. They may have the potential, but praise will stop their growth. And we do that far too often in our lodges. We create an atmosphere that feeds on praise. So we wonder, why are we not having that sensation of progress? Because we're undermining it by this little slight turn. Recognize contribution rather than completion, or quality over quantity, and promote perseverance rather than giving up. If, you know, somebody hasn't done the work to prepare, hasn't done the work and you know it, recognize their contribution for what it is. Not smooth it over with some false praise. It's insincere. And it has a corrosive effect on the audience. And it means that that kind of work that you're praising is sufficient. Really? What gives you the right to judge that? Don't build false esteem. False self-esteem. Don't. Build determinism and confidence. You have the ability to do many things if you work hard. I have the ability to do many things if I work hard. So you're not sitting there saying, oh man, he hasn't done any of this and stood in front of a crowd since he was in school. Well, so what? If he tries, it's not a hostile environment, but throwing false praise at him is ridiculous. We want to encourage him. He deserves to hear the encouragement, not to be stopped and have his feet sunk in cement. People who receive encouragement or genuine praise are much more resilient because they're focused on their effort and believe they can change their circumstance through determination or learning. And they're not as shaken by adversity. Good. They're not as shaken. That's what we want, people that are able to have their feet rooted up firmly on the ground, not so precarious searching out praise. Oh my goodness, I can't do it. I didn't get the right amount of praise, so I'm never going to try that again. We've brought this confusion on ourselves. People who receive high fives for doing mundane tasks begin to expect praise when praise isn't called for. That's what we've got going on in a lot of lodges, brethren. And they take it personally when it doesn't come. Like, who the hell are you, you know? They do, over-personalized. So if we're going to do this, make this kind of change, it needs the narrative, that bridging, an explanation. So we're all singing from the same song sheet, at least in this regard. So we recognize the false encouragement of esteem for what it is. Praise is. It's ineffective and it's counterproductive. Of course, it's okay to express pride. It's a natural way to demonstrate love and support. And it's important to understand that if self-confidence and development are the goals, encouragement is a much more useful strategy. Well, masonry whispers in our ear constantly about the apprentice. Constantly about our apprentice. Yes, self-confidence and development are the goals. And when our brethren are on their own and faced with a challenge, we know it won't help them to think, why can't I do this? I should be smart enough. But it will serve them well to think, this is tough, but with effort, I can probably figure it out. Too much of one, not enough of the other, brethren. So as Masons, we can do a lot of these things early on. There's no need to take drastic steps. But some reflective thoughts and words of encouragement to our brethren to focus on effort and growth throughout the seasons. And that will ensure their joy comes from an internal ability and confidence in their own skills rather than, you know, pat in the head from you and I. It's time to go. Oh, my goodness. Here. maybe Masonry has had this kind of an effect on you as it has on me and so many others of us for hundreds of years. I hope you go on and have an excellent week. I appreciate your support. We always do here at Masonic Effects. I look forward to joining you again soon. This is a young woman by the name of Josh Stone. You bottoms up today. I think you might like this one. It's called I Put a Spell on You. It's from a German jazz festival that went on earlier this year. Yeah. A little bit of fun.
not